Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome everybody to the Dragon's Lair. And as you know by now, I am no longer at that other network. Hopefully this broadcast will go okay. I'm using my old computer to do it on, and I am also using a new headset, and everything tested okay, but I can't be sure till it's all said and done and I listen to this. So anyway, fingers crossed. I'm doing this show sort of as a prerequisite for my next show, which will get into the issues of why I am no longer at that other network. But these issues here tonight will be related and are important. And it's also important in the sense of that there are so many new people to this movement that there is some history, I'm sure, that is lacking in at least some of the people. And I also want to mention, too, here that I'm going to be getting some dental work done here pretty soon. And there may be a period of time where I'm not doing any shows as a result. And I mentioned in my third show that I did on that other network that I had some dental issues that were giving me problems, so to speak. And they still are. They may be more detectable with this headset than the other one that I've been using or the telephone. We'll see how it sounds. So, anyway, hopefully I can get these resolved at some point in the near future. Tonight's topics: Jewish lackeys in the racialist, nationalist, and the National Socialist movement. Also, the founding of the National Socialist movement. At a certain point, anyway, the 30-year war against the National Socialist Movement and the conspiracy of June 30th, 2006. And I will get to that more specifically at a later point. For the record, today is October 1st, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 7 degrees Libra. Again, I have no personal website or blog. Probably not have a life if I did. Between doing these shows and work and other stuff going on. And I'll get to some issues on the other stuff going on in just a second here. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. It's magus_18@geocities.com. Send me an email saying subscribe or just write me. And I can't guarantee that I can always respond to all of my emails. I never got around to sending out that other email. Various reasons. I'll get to that in a second. There will be no calls tonight. Got the dog outside. Hopefully he'll behave during the next couple of hours and I won't have to stop and bring him in. Not sure where the cat is. And eventually I'm going to get all my other shows uploaded here on this particular Blog Talk Radio account. And so anyway, something I wanted to mention, and this may be also an issue for some shows in the near future, we'll see. About a month ago, before probably maybe even a little bit more than a month ago, before I left the other network, had to handle some issues that was all kind of going on at the same time that everything was going on at Renegade. And essentially, most of you know that I'm 52 years old. Well, I'll be 53 in about three or four weeks here. Actually, about three. And I still have one living grandparent, believe it or not. And she had just turned 49 when I was born. And about 3 weeks after she turned 49, I was born. And if she lives long enough on October 9th, which is only like 8 or 9 days away, she will be 102 years old. Well, about a month ago, she started having problems. She's been in a nursing home for a good 11 years or so. Maybe 12, and she's been in and out of the hospital a few times, but She always went back to the nursing home. But this time she went to the hospital, and she was there for, you know, probably about 4 days or so, maybe five. I don't remember exactly. And they told her that she, told us rather, that she was probably not going to recoup from the issue that she went in for. And so we have put her in a hospice. And at that time, they probably, I think they told us it would probably be, maybe she had 3 or 4 more weeks. And of course, there's no real way of knowing. I mean, you know, she could go another 6 months, who knows, but I don't think so. So anyway, she, you know, if she, again, if she makes it another 8 or 9 days, she'll be 102. I guess it would kind of suck to pass away short of your 102nd birthday. But anyway, we'll see what happens. But there's also other issues related to that once she does pass away that have to be handled. And so there's a lot of things that could theoretically interfere with me doing shows. I could also possibly get to some point where I just don't want to do them anymore. You know, I've done my time in this movement. And I think it's time for other people to. And I said before I ever started doing these that I looked forward to the day where I wouldn't have to do any shows. And that younger people could step up and have all the information, or at least most of it, that I have been able to learn. And I don't know that that is quite the case yet, but, you know, I can only do so much. And, of course, I also have my own life to live. And I'll be, again, I'll be 53 in 3 weeks. And so, you know, I have some time I would like to spend not worrying about this sort of thing. Unfortunately, I wish I could just, you know, unfortunately, I just wish, let me put it this way. I wish I could just say, you know, look, you guys just take the reins and move on. But I don't think that we're going to have that much time. Anyone saying that we've got 50 years is full of shit. You know, I think we'll be lucky if we have 7 to 10 before shit starts hitting the fan. And I've said personally, I don't know if I've said it on any broadcast or not, but that we probably only have till the point where I would say half of the baby boomers hit age 65 or older. And, of course, the baby boom generation was born from 1945 to 1965. It's a 20-year span. The peak birth periods were like 57, 58, and then like, I think, 60, 61, somewhere in that neighborhood. And so, you know, half would be about maybe 56, 55, based on the peak years of birth. You know, that's just a rough estimate. And, of course, 65. Well, I'm, you know, obviously a good 12 years from that point. So, over 13. So, anyway, I really don't think we've got beyond that point. And, of course, I'm born at this three-quarters point of that. So, anyway, we'll see what happens. But nevertheless, I'm also a little rusty here. I haven't done a show in almost a month. And so you're going to have to bear with me a little bit. I'm not quite back into the swing of things. I'm having to double-check myself here and there. I've done a couple of shows here where it was involved other recordings. One was a Jeff Rentz interview of someone. That show's been posted to the public. I've got 2 shows that, as of the time that I'm talking at the moment, have not been posted publicly. But they involve recordings, and I don't really do any talking in them. And it'll be known at the time this show is released. So you'll understand what I'm talking about. So anyway, I just wanted to mention, too, though, that as long as I'm doing these shows, you know, I'm going to continue with the Texas series. And if I don't do anything else at all, I'll probably still do the Texas series. But, you know, I intend to, you know, always talk about the Jews, if I, you know, other than the Texas series, if I keep going. And occasionally some astrology and some esoteric subjects and the occult, et cetera, et cetera. And I mentioned that my next show before I decided to leave was going to be regarding ideas that Jews promote, false ideas that Jews promote. It's almost kind of related to what I'm going to be talking about here tonight in the next show. And again, the next show will be a response to Renegade and about why I left and some of the issues that were occurring. And another item I want to do. I've got some things that I want to do regarding the paranormal. And actually, that should actually be somewhat entertaining. And no, I'm not shifting to try to entertain people. But this is a good time of year for that type of material. You know, with Samhain, a.k.a. Halloween, coming up on the 31st. You know, and as the sun enters Scorpio and from Libra. And, you know, I don't know how much of it I will do. But we'll see. I got a call. Hold on. And so I also have a friend who lives in Russia. Lives near Moscow. I'm not going to say exactly where he lives. That I want to interview. And we got to work out the scheduling. You know, he's about 8 hours ahead. 8 or 9 hours, I think. And so it's like I'm going to have to stay up real late at night and try and catch him when he's waking up or something. You know, shortly after he gets woken up. That's probably the best, you know. I don't function until I've been up for several hours. That's just the way it is. Now, my friend over there, is an author of a book. He has also been involved in this movement for many, many years. He is also from Texas. He was born in Dallas and raised in Deep East Texas. He does have a Texas accent more than I have. And he has not lost it since he's moved to Russia. He went there shortly after the wall came down in the 90s. Actually, right before, I believe. He went there on business and decided to stay. I can't say that was a bad move, actually, but nevertheless, I think he's got some good insight on some issues. And one of the people I will be discussing tonight, well, he's got some information on that. You know, as my show description said, it was going to be about David Duke and Tom Metzger. As you know, David Duke took a trip to Russia here a few years ago. And he wants to pass on some info on that. And, of course, I think David Duke's character is more than questionable. But I'd like to get him to give us his direct take on it. And so anyway, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to go ahead and play another song, and then I'm going to come back and we'll get into the topics for tonight. So, let me get to the studio here, and we'll play this song.
Oh, mama, I'm in fear for my life from the long arm of the law. Lawman is putting an end to my running and I'm so far from my home.
Oh, mama, I can hear you a crying. crying, you're so scared and all alone. Hangman is coming down from the gallows, and I don't have very long.
Okay, well, what I've got here, and I'll say what the name of the article is when I'm done. I've got a section that I'm going to read about David Duke and then a section about Tom Metzger. This should give everybody some general background on these two individuals that, if they are not aware of, they will be afterwards. So, anyway, let me go ahead and get into it here. This is called... Well, I'll tell you again later. Okay, David Duke has been a professional racist for his entire adult life, wrote Tyler Bridges, author of The Rise of David Duke, a biography of Duke's early years. He deeply believes his anti-Semitic political philosophy, but it has also been a way for him to get money from his followers. It is how he makes a living. Duke has spent virtually his entire career living off the kindness of strangers, people who mistakenly thought he was championing their cause for no other reason than a desire to help whites. He sold and resold supposedly secret mailing list, raised money under false pretenses, and lived off the proceeds of fundraising for at least 10 different political campaigns. He womanized shamelessly and spent thousands on cosmetic surgery for himself, including liposuction to his buttocks. From his formative years as a supposed National Socialist, and many of you probably did not know that he was, because you knew he was in the Klan, but you didn't know that. Anyway, from his formative years as a supposed National Socialist right up to the present, David Duke's foremost concern always has been David Duke. For 30 years now, America's best-known white supremacist has engaged in a striking pattern of financial chicanery and self-serving ripoffs. David Duke has one paramount skill which he has exhibited throughout his whole life, an incredible ability to reinvent himself. He does it every few years, from National Socialist to Klansman to suit and tie racist to state legislature and political wheeler dealer to quasi-intellectual author to globe-trotting celebrity collecting meaningless honorary degrees from Eastern European universities no one has ever heard of, to prison martyr, to elder statesman of the movement. Duke has packed a dozen lifetimes of bourgeois into one. David's refusal to be fettered by any considerations of truth or honesty, combined with a total, complete, and utter shamelessness unparalleled even in the notably shameless white movement, have made him the movement's premier operator and public figure. Along with Dr. William L. Pierce, Duke can probably be considered as being one of the movement's success stories in the purely personal sense. He has lived a life of excitement, adventure, and luxury, and all on someone else's dime. Unlike Ed Fields, who practiced as a chiropractor for some years, and Dr. William L. Pierce, who at least did a couple of years as an assistant college professor in the 1960s at age 57 at the time of his writing, David Duke can honestly say that he has never worked a single day in his life. Duke has been in more tight corners than a feather duster. He has stolen what has to be millions of dollars down through the years and has only done one short prison sentence. No one else in the movement can match that record except for Pierce, who may have stolen slightly less, but who never did a day behind bars. Well, I don't know if he stole it or not, but anyway, there is a section on Dr. Pierce here. But I think of all the people in this movement, Dr. Pierce is clearly the one who is the most trustworthy and believable. Okay. David Duke began his racial career while a college student as a member of Matt Cole's NSWPP for a brief period of time. Duke has always tried to disavow or deny this period in his life, but his enemies still to this day glory in publishing a photo of Duke taken in 1971 while he was picketing the student union at LSU wearing a brown shirt and a swastika armband. When confronted with this photo and circumstances where he can't slither out of it, Duke haramps and says his Nazi period was a youthful mistake. During one of his trips to Arlington, Virginia in about 1971, Duke stopped by to visit Dr. Pierce of the National Alliance across Interstate 95 from the NSWPP headquarters. According to Rick Cooper, Dr. Pierce offered to give David Duke the information regarding Matt Cole's homosexual background if Duke would publish this information in his Klan publication at the time, called The Crusader. Duke refused for reasons which remain obscure. Now, I don't know for sure if Matt Cole is one or was one or whatever. I know that the accusations have been placed on him. Now, he's been on my E-list for years. He's getting up there in age. Last time we tried to communicate, he couldn't remember who I was. Although, when you read what he wrote, he sounded coherent. but he couldn't remember me. And I've got emails going back years from him as well as to him. But anyway, nevertheless, I'll continue on. Again, Duke refused for reasons which remain obscure why he would wish to maintain the secret of a highly placed homosexual in the movement is unknown. After visiting Dr. Pierce, Duke visited Matt Cole at the NSWPP headquarters. Subsequently, Duke spoke with the NSWPP duty officer, James N. Mason, and told Mason of Dr. Pierce's offer. Jim Mason, years later, told this to Rick Cooper, who then wrote to Duke asking for an account, confirmation, or denial that Dr. Pierce made such an offer. Duke never replied. David Duke first got caught with his hand in the till in 1972, shortly after he temporarily dropped out of Louisiana State University, or LSU, to devote himself to full-time neo-Nazi activism, according to Bridges' book. Police arrested Duke and three others for allegedly raising $500 for George Wallace's presidential campaign and pocketing the money. The charges were dropped after an influential Duke mentor convinced the Wallace campaign officials to change their story. By 1974, Duke had founded the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and it wasn't long before he became the media's favorite Klan leader. Vowing to modernize the Klan, he urged his acolytes to get out of the cow pasture and into hotel meeting rooms. After appearing on Tom Snyder's Tomorrow talk show, he was unable to use his newfound celebrity to recruit Louis Beam, Don Black, and Tom Metzger, who each went on to play key roles in America's white nationalist movement. Now, I don't believe Don Black's real name is Black. I think it's Schwartz, which is Jewish. Hold on. Okay. I just find it interesting here that so many people in this movement have names that could be Jewish. Yeah. I mean, it's some names are Gentile, and then Jews adopt them, but these names are still Jewish names in the sense that Jews use them. You know, for example, my first name is David. Most people think that is Jewish. No, it's not. It comes from Egypt. D-V-D-T-U-T-U-T. And that is essentially, it derives from Tut, like Tutmosis. Of course, Moses comes from Moses. So, anyway, King Tut, that would be the same as David. But Jews use David as a last name as well as a first name. And typically, many Jews, if they have a last name, typically if someone has a last name that is a first name, it is typically Jewish. Not always, but most of the time. So anyway, let me continue on here. During the same period, starting with a failed 1975 bid for the Louisiana State Senate, Duke began a series of political campaigns. It appears certain they were at least partly funded with money taken from his Klan group's coffers. Before long, several of Duke's most intimate allies began to grow weary of his self-serving personality and his constant, unquenchable greed for money. William Pierce, who Duke had begun corresponding with when the Louisianan was still a teenager, admonished Duke to quit taking credit for an important Rice pamphlet. I'm sorry, Rice, not Rice. Pierce pamphlet called Who Runs the Media? Others in the racist movement angrily responded to Duke's notorious womanizing, which was almost pathological. Duke hit on any female he saw, literally within a matter of minutes of meeting her. Single women, married women, female reporters, waitresses, women he saw on the street, it didn't matter. His sexual obsession approached the medical condition known as satiriasis, S-A-T-Y-R-I-A-S-I-S. S-A-T-Y-R-I-A-S-I-S. And I want to mention here at this point that that topic will be what my friend in Russia will be discussing when and if I get him on. Hopefully I can. Among other things we'll talk about. For example, he said that all this about Syria is being overplayed by the Western media. But anyway, we'll see what happens on that too. Word soon got out that no one could trust their wives, daughters, sisters, or for that matter, mothers alone in David Duke's presence. And many Duke functions to this day turn into an elaborate dance or game to try and keep Duke away from any attractive females present. Now, there's this article has been edited a little bit. I'm sure it's been compiled. But anyway, there's a little section here called Editor's Note, and I'm going to read that. It says, I have heard from an old resistance activist that Duke was so noted for sexual misbehavior that in many cases the organizers of Duke events would hire Duke to speak at their events and sign autographs and mingle an hour after banquet room speeches with the condition that Duke was not allowed to go out from Duke's motel room before or after Duke's speeches under pain of not being paid for his performances. Duke would be fed takeout food and a literal guard would be posted at Duke's motel or hotel room to prevent Duke's misbehavior. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but Duke wouldn't like these conditions, but since Duke loves money, would accept and settle down without whining too much about the unfairness of it all. There are also a number of Klansmen in Louisiana who want to whoop Duke's ass for selling secret mailing lists to anybody with cash money. The latest this happened was selling a Klan mailing list to Republican candidate for Louisiana Governor Robert Fowler, who won the election back in 1996. Now, again, I don't know when this article was written and how much of it is all true or not, but a good portion of it has got to be because where there's smoke, there's fire. And I'll continue with the editor's note. David Duke's didos are well known to the movement. They come as a surprise only to the sort of newbies who are looking for great white leaders and thus join Stormfront or BNNF. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and get back to the article now. Duke's shady financial dealings grew harder and harder to conceal as well. As the 1970s drew to a close, with growing numbers of followers deserting his Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, Duke was accused by several Klan officials of stealing his organization's money. Duke is nothing but a con artist, Jack Gregory, Duke's Florida state leader, told the Clearwater, Florida Sun, after his boss allegedly refused to turn over proceeds from a series of 1979 Klan rallies to the Knights. And that Sun is a newspaper, Clearwater, Florida Sun. In 1979, after his first abortive run for president as a Democrat and a series of highly publicized violent Klan incidents, Duke quietly incorporated the nonprofit National Association for the Advancement of White People, the NAAWP, in an attempt to leave the baggage of the Klan behind. But before he made it public, he contacted Bill Wilkinson, a former Duke underling who now headed a rival Klan group. Duke invited Wilkinson to a remote Alabama farmhouse where he offered to sell for $35,000 his secret membership list, a cardinal offense for a Klan leader who had promised to keep his members' names secret at all costs. Wilkinson had feigned interest, but secretly invited two reporters to witness the transaction. Duke and his disciple, Don Black, were caught on video and audio tape as they handed a brown paper bag filled with index cards with his members' names to Wilkinson. 3 days later, after Duke's sellout had received national publicity, he publicly announced the formation of the NAAWP, attacking Wilkinson as he did so. He said he was trying to get away from the Hollywood image of the Klan. In May of 1981, David Duke became involved in one of the most bizarre episodes in the history of the white nationalist movement, and considering the incredible profusion of bizarre incidents in our movement, that's saying a lot. This was the abortive invasion of the Caribbean island of Dominica by a team of mercenaries recruited from Canadian organized crime, as well as from Harold Covington's North Carolina NSPA unit, all of whom were arrested on the word of an informer while passing through Duke's New Orleans turf on their way to the invasion. Duke's exact role in this bizarre fiasco has never been completely explained, but Duke was apparently the liaison between former Dominican Prime Minister Patrick John, who is black, and the hit team. John was seeking to overthrow the government of Eugenia Charles, and in exchange for the band of hired guns provided by Duke, agreed to build a casino on the island for the Canadian mob. Presumably, somewhere along the line, Duke would have gotten a cut, or at least a line of credit. Duke's fascination with Caribbean casino gambling appears to have roots a lot farther back than the incidents he eventually went to prison for. Duke slithered out of this one by cooperating fully with the federal prosecutors and testifying fully and extensively before a grand jury, spilling his guts under a grant of immunity. Afterward, as with so much else that is shameful and treacherous in Duke's past, this episode was simply airbrushed out of the picture. Tyler Bridges, who was then an investigative reporter for the New Orleans Times, Picayune, I can't pronounce that, it's P-I-C-A-U-N-E, that's some sort of Cajun or Creole terminology, Picayune, I think it's the way it's pronounced, the New Orleans Times Picayune newspaper, revealed in 1989 that Duke secretly owned two companies. The first, Americana Books, sold racial books from his legislative office in the basement of his home, which was technically illegal, although admittedly Louisiana legislatures have always had a very laid-back attitude on legal matters, as I have said before. The second, Business Consultant and Enterprises, or BC&E, was set up by Duke in 1978. Tax returns filed by the NAAWP showed that it had paid BC&E $119,625 from 1983 to 1988 for mailing list maintenance, meaning updating. Duke's short-lived 1979 through 1980 campaign for president, Bridges revealed, also had paid BC&E $19,900 to rent space in Duke's home. In sum, Bridges writes in his book, BC&E, in other words, Duke, from 1983 to 1988, when Duke ran for president on the far-right Populist Party ticket, received $141,000 from the NAAWP in Duke's two presidential campaigns. The arrangement was apparently legal. In 1987, Duke and Don Black traveled to Forsyth County, Georgia, to take advantage of simmering racial tension between blacks and the Klan. After they were arrested and charged with reckless conduct during a shouting match with a black man, Duke set up a defense fund for himself that had an almost identical name to another fund set up to aid 62 white supremacists who'd been arrested earlier. After raising at least $8,000 from backers who mistakenly believed they were helping the 62 men arrested with Duke and Black, Duke ultimately pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor charge. He was fined a grand total of $55. Let me clear my throat. It was late in the 1980s that Duke began a series of more serious campaigns for political office. He had enough political savvy to understand that parading around with a swastika armband, as he had done during his college days, would be counterproductive. So he toned down the vitriol and avoided the crudest rhetoric. He also dyed his hair blonde and visited a plastic surgeon to reduce the size of his nose. A chin implant altered his profile, and chemical peels removed bags and wrinkles around his eyes. On at least two occasions, Duke had also had liposuction to his buttocks. Since obviously we can't have a great white leader with a fat ass now, can we? Duke's 1988 Populist Party presidential campaign was a miserable failure, with him taking just 48,267 votes, a 0.05% of the total, but he was not discouraged. And in 1989, masquerading as a born-again Republican, Duke ran for a seat in the Louisiana state legislature and narrowly beat a complacent incumbent. Up to then, a nose job was the only job that Duke had ever had. It was the beginning of David Duke's heyday, the period when he would come to the attention of millions of people worldwide as he ran a series of high-profile political campaigns. In late 1989, just months after winning his state campaign, he announced his candidacy in the Republican primary for the United States Senate. Over the course of the next year, he would raise a remarkable $2.4 million, part of it through a political advertisement that asked supporters to call a fee-charging 900 number. Huge difference there. Fee-charging 900 number. In the end, isn't that interesting? Just add an R to fee and you have free. In the end, he won 607,391 votes, or almost 60% of the white vote, but lost the primary. Duke regrouped almost immediately, running for Louisiana governor against Edwin Edwards in a campaign marked by one of the most remarkable bumper stickers in political history: "Vote for the crook. It's important," is what it said. And that was devised by anti-Duke forces urging a vote for Edwards. Running in a crowded field, Duke came up with within two percentage points of Edwards, forcing him into a runoff. In the runoff, Duke captured 671,009 votes, but lost to Edwards by 22 percentage points. During the gubernatorial campaign, Duke held rally after rally, passing large plastic buckets through the crowds to raise cash, a method of fundraising that is illegal under both Louisiana and federal law, which requires that officials issue cash receipts and keep records of donations. After a lengthy investigation, Duke was fined $1,111. Next, Duke announced with great fanfare that he would seek the Republican nomination for President of the United States in 1992, but his campaign fizzled as most potential supporters backed right-wing commentator Patrick Buchanan, who espoused many of the same positions as Duke without carrying his baggage. Of course, Duke never stood a chance, but that wasn't the point. He came out ahead no matter how he fared at the ballot box. According to Bridges' book, Duke told an assistant that by running for president, he helped to double the size of his computerized mailing list, which by now included 125,000 names. The list would be the source of future income. Over the years, Duke would run for political office no less than 10 times. After a while, the spectacle of Duke as a perennial candidate, a man who seemed more interested in campaigning and living off his campaigns than in actually winning, started to wear thin on voters, but he still wielded considerable influence in Louisiana politics. In some cases, merely dipping his toe into a political campaign gained him leverage and bargaining power with other candidates. After briefly entering the Louisiana governor's race in 1995, Duke dropped out and endorsed Mike Foster, a candidate who would go on to win the election. Duke's endorsement may well have given the edge to Foster, who had cut a backroom deal with the former Imperial Wizard, ostensibly to rent his mailing list for some $152,000. One Duke aide, Kenny Knight, told Talk Magazine that he had met Foster secretly to work out details of the deal. Knight claimed that Foster agreed to Duke's three conditions: to switch from the Democrat to Republican Party, to make his first act as governor the abolition of the state affirmative action program, and to never attack Duke. Knight said that Foster agreed to all three conditions. For his part, Foster did switch parties when he announced his candidacy and then went on to eliminate the affirmative action program shortly after taking office. Foster, who never used the list during his 1995 campaign, had attempted to hide this payment to Duke, routing it through intermediaries. After it was finally disclosed in 1999, the State Board of Ethics fined Foster $20,000 for failing to disclose the deal. Let me light this cigarette. Duke, meanwhile, was confronted by federal agents who asked him how he had failed to pay taxes on the income. Duke claimed his accountant had made a mistake and hurriedly paid up his long overdue taxes and penalties. The high price of the mailing list, newspapers pointed out, that it sold for much more than such lists normally do, raised suspicions about what it was that Foster had actually bought. Some critics suggested Duke was being paid off to stay out of the race. In any event, a federal grand jury looking into Duke's finances queried him two times in 1999 about the mailing list he had sold to Foster. Instead of answering, Duke took the Fifth Amendment. Duke, realizing he was a target, was worried. He confided to Lori Eden, his girlfriend at the time, that he had lost at least $50,000 at the gambling tables. "I would ask him if he wanted to go to the casino," Eden told the intelligence report. "And he would say, 'No, I can't, because the FBI may see me and they're on to me.'" He knew way ahead of the time that he was going to get in trouble. He made a comment to me once, "I do love you, but I'm going to jail." He also tried to hint that he wouldn't be around. What he meant was, is he was going to Russia, added Eden, who at the time was a 33-year-old swimsuit and lingerie model with her own adult website. He knew they were coming after him, so he made sure to get the hell out of here before they actually picked him up to question him. Let me clear my throat here. Eden, who would break up with David Duke when he left for Russia, said that at one point in the relationship, she had a pregnancy scare. Duke, a self-described pro-lifer who has railed publicly against abortion for whites for years, suggested that they travel to Paris to get her the abortion pill that was then illegal in America. He said, "I know. I've been through this before," he recounted. He also said that it would kill him politically. It was during the 1990s, specifically between 1993 and 99, that Duke was engaged in a long-running ripoff of his followers. FBI agents reported that Duke and his colleagues cooked up a series of false excuses for beseeching the faithful for ever more funds. In one letter, for instance, he claimed he was facing financial ruin and the loss of his home. In fact, he sold his Metairie home, that's a town in Mississippi, at a profit shortly after that letter, and bought a larger residence in Manville, Louisiana. His staff would laugh at the often untruthful excuses Duke concocted, an FBI affidavit said. Some of the proceeds from these bogus direct mail appeals were deposited in a bank account that was under the name of an ex-girlfriend, but controlled by Duke, who maintained in excess of 30 credit cards, according to the FBI. During just one 16-month period, Duke collected $230,000 in small checks from his supporters. Duke was simultaneously undergoing something of a political metamorphosis, or more accurately, a dropping of the mask. Since leaving the Klan, he had worked endlessly to put his Klan, and especially his National Socialist past, behind him. But in 1998, he self-published his autobiography entitled My Awakening. The book, which Duke enthusiastically predicted would change the course of history, did nothing of the kind. One reviewer said of My Awakening, "It's all right, the political and racial parts of it, although it's all been said before others. Large sections of it are basically just narcissistic bullshit, with Duke breaking his arm, patting himself on the back. It certainly doesn't justify or ameliorate the harm Duke has done to the movement with his constant financial and sexual misbehavior." This did not preclude Duke from starting in early 2000 the National Organization for European American Rights, or NOFEAR, N-O-F-E-A-R, which purported to be a group devoted to pursuing civil rights for whites, not to hating anyone. The next year, after a sporting goods company sued Duke over the use of its name, NOFEAR would be renamed the European American Unity and Rights Organization, or EURO, E-U-R-O. On November 16, 2000, a dozen federal agents raided Duke's two-story home in Manville and carted away 22 boxes of papers, computer disks, credit card records, and other documents. Roy Armstrong, his longtime bodyguard and chauffeur, was there during the speech and termed it a mere fishing expedition. But Duke wasn't about to be reeled in. He was in Russia on his fourth visit, and he would not return to the United States until reaching a plea agreement in December 2002. From a safe distance, Duke insisted on his innocence. Make no mistake about it, he would write in a No Fear newsletter, "This probe is nothing more than a political assassination on the part of government officials who are seeking to silence my voice on our European heritage and rights." In the meantime, he said, he was moving to Moscow to struggle against people of other colors and Jews. It is clear that Duke understood perfectly that he was in trouble back home. That's why he spent the next 2 years traveling in Russia and throughout Europe, giving speeches and hobnobbing with other extremists. For some reason, which was never explained, the government never issued a federal fugitive warrant or asked the State Department to cancel his passport. Overall, he sought to give the impression that he was devoted to building a transnational movement. The reality, however, was that Duke spent most of his time selling his books, meeting privately with prominent rightists, and giving talks. He was also desperately seeking to find a Russian or Eastern European woman willing to marry him in order to obtain permanent citizenship in Russia or some other Eastern European country before his passport expired and he was forced to either return to the United States or commit a clear federal felony by being abroad without a valid travel document, thus handing the government a handle on him and allowing them to issue a federal fugitive warrant. However, for once, Duke's magnetic sex appeal seems to have failed him. Duke complained to his followers back home that while young and beautiful candidates for matrimony abounded, none of them wanted to remain in Mother Russia with him. Hard-headed and practical and every bit as mercenary as he was, those Russian beauties were all looking for a green card to come to America, not shelter a fugitive American back home in bum fucks with no solid source of income. By late 2002, with his passport almost expired, Duke's attorney was negotiating a plea agreement for his client, who had grown tired of being a nationalist without a nation. When news of the plea became public, Vince Breeding, national director of Euro, said Duke was pleading because he would surely lose in court at the hands of a mostly black jury. This is probably true. It is also certainly true that Duke was guilty as sin of embezzlement and monumental deceit and dishonesty, and he would have been convicted by an all-white jury as well. Euro communiques painted the group's founder as a living martyr for our cause. Breeding, the former lead guitarist in a satanic rock band called Acheron, was later expelled from Duke's Euro organization when he was caught running an internet porno operation off the group's servers and not giving Duke a cut. I don't know much about that band. I've heard of them. Let me relight this cigarette. A lot of satanic bands are more of the LaVey stripe than anything else, however, which is part of the reason they don't really appeal to me that much. And there's this issue of most of them kind of all sounding the same or having the same sound, however you want to describe it. It's kind of like listening to Mexican music. You know, it's like, didn't they just play that song? It all has the same beat. Anyway, on December 14, 2002, Duke slunk into a federal courthouse in New Orleans and pleaded guilty to tax evasion and mail fraud, ripping off hundreds of thousands of dollars from earnest white supremacist donors who thought they were helping Duke to save the white race. Instead, as Duke admitted in the allocution for his guilty pleas, he had cynically raised money by using a series of lies and then blown it at casino craps tables. Under the terms of his plea bargain, he received a slap on the wrist sentence of 15 months in a low-security prison. It is a testament to the enduring quality of David Duke's hokum that while he was in prison, he continued to raise money by mail. This is what the Jews call chutzpah, and Duke has enough of it for a dozen rabbis. When he was released in May of 2004, it was ostensibly to a halfway house, which he apparently never even bothered to check into, and no one knows how he got away with that. David Duke hit the ground running, and in one of the most ghastly and surreal episodes in the movement history, he was welcomed back into the fold with open arms at a gala event by 400 supporters hosted at a New Orleans luxury hotel. While some of the biggest names in the movement gathered around this self-admitted thief on the speaker's platform and eulogized him to the stars, he was also spotted in a riverboat casino barely a month after his release, a dizzy blonde on his arm and rolling them bones like there was no tomorrow. How did he get away with it? It is difficult not to speculate that Duke's surgically enhanced, handsome good looks have something to do with it, appealing to the homoerotic dimension that always lurks behind the surface of the white nationalist movement. Yeah, that's what it says. I didn't add that, okay? It's like an abused spouse who refuses to leave her abuser. He beats her. She seeks the lipstick on his collar and smells the liquor on his breath. She knows he's cheating on her and drinking up the rent money, but she just keeps on bleeding. But he's my husband. He's promised he'll change, and this time I believe him. The man's arrogance and his contempt for his supporters is nothing short of breathtaking, and they lap it up like candy and beg for more. David Duke has been globetrotting around Europe again for almost 2 years now, living off donations he receives from the United States, sale of his books, etc., precisely how a convicted federal felon managed to obtain a passport from the State Department is a question which the movement has apparently decided not to examine too closely, or examine at all. In fact, once again, David Ernest Duke is doing what he does best. He's getting away with it. Okay, now I'm going to go back to the studio here, and if I can get this thing out of my way. I don't know how I'd manage to pull that off. Ha! Okay. Hold on just one sec. I got to figure out how to get back to the studio here. I've got the area where you scroll the tabs at the top covered by the Skype, whatchamacallit, for the phone call here. So anyway, tell you what, I'm just going to go over to here to this other computer, and I'm going to find the song. See, I've got more than one computer going on the studio here, just in case my other computer just all of a sudden stops, which it's done before, for whatever reason. So I'm going to go ahead and play this song right here, if I can get it to work. Here we go. Okay, now, the next item I'm going to discuss is the betrayal of Tom Metzger. Now, Dr. Pierce once called Tom Metzger, quote, that Bolshevik, unquote. And, of course, Metzger pushes this atheistic philosophy. You know, it's kind of odd. You got Duke pushing Christianity, and then you got Metzger pushing atheism, and both appear to be opposites, and they are in a certain kind of way, but at the same time, they're really the same, as we know if you've been listening to any of my shows, as well as one of the shows that Lou did on the topic of Christianity and communism, of course, connected to atheism, Atheism is the stepping off point for Christianity. And let me define atheism here. Most people are under the impression that, well, you just don't believe in God. And, of course, most people will automatically presume Yahweh or Jehovah. Of course, then, really it would be like, say, any God. But what it really means is, and not just materialism, as some like to say, it is actually the belief that the physical is all there is, that there is no spirit, nothing spiritual, no soul, no anything else. Now, of course, if you look at it from the Christian and the atheistic perspective, none of them would even be aware that there is, unless you are capable of spirituality, or not necessarily just capable, although capable applies. I find it interesting how mixed races have a problem with spirituality. I'll come back to that. Not this show. Next show. So anyway, you've got Metzger pushing that, and even some quasi-Christian values, in a sense. Let me just read this, and then I've got another something else small to read afterwards. In February 1994, the Montgomery, Alabama Advertiser published a series of articles exposing the assorted financial and legal skullduggeries of the loathsome Morris Seligman Dees, director of the Southern Poverty Law Center. It needs to be remembered that the information which was released about Tom Metzger in this article came in an anti-Dees context, mentioned almost in passing. One section dealt with the 1990 Portland, Oregon lawsuit that Dees won against Tom and John Metzger of White Aryan Resistance or War, John being his son, over the highly tenuous allegation that they were liable for the death of an Ethiopian kafir named Mulageta Serah. I think I said that right. The Metzgers lost the suit largely because Metzger chose to defend himself and did so with extreme incompetence. They were assessed civil damages of $12.5 million. Both Metzgers were placed under court-ordered financial supervision until the year 2011 to make sure this atrocious judgment is paid. They became, and essentially still are, financial slaves of Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center. The Portland verdict was unquestionably a disgraceful travesty of justice, which even many liberals and left-wing civil libertarians admit they find troubling because of its potential for application against so-called progressives at a future date. Thanks in part to the Portland verdict, lefty community and environmental groups are already being wiped out through similar misuse of civil liability by developers and large corporations in so-called SLAPP suits, S-L-A-P-P suits, and the C2 internet service provider is targeted by a Portland-style lawsuit making a similar claim that they are liable for allegedly unlawful acts of people over whom they have no control. In other words, a cyber version of the Portland precedent. Ironically, C2, and that is C with a 2, had close ties with NIZKOR, N-I-Z-K-O-R, whose deranged associates, including director Ken Oy McVeigh, praised Dees and the Portland verdict to the skies. And that's Ken McVeigh, Oy being a nickname. Ken Oy McVeigh praised Dees and the Portland verdict to the skies. What concerned everyone in the movement, though, is the revelation that, as part of his efforts to collect the judgment, Morris Dees seized control of the War Post Office Box 6557, 65 in Fallbrook, California, a legally appointed agent of the Southern Poverty Law Center, San Diego Attorney General McElroy, was given the authority to collect the mail from the box, open and examine it, extract 50% of the funds sent to Metzger by white racial nationalists for video or book orders or donations to war. McElroy then placed this money, in a trust fund for the Ethiopian who was the shill for the lawsuit. The remaining money was passed on to Tom and John Metzger. This kind of arrangement is standard practice in collecting civil damage awards from businesses, but it essentially made Tom Metzger an employee of Morris Dees, since Dees decided how much money Metzger got every month and quite literally signed his paycheck. This went on for years, and so far as anyone knows, is still going on. McElroy may also be assumed to have read and copied the mail sent to war and passed it along to Morris Dees. To maintain that McElroy and other court-appointed receivers since then have courteously averted their eyes from the names and addresses and contents of the letters they opened is a proposition so improbable, not to say naive and ridiculous, that it need not be discussed further. It is for this reason, not so much the seizure of the money, as bad as that is, that Tom and John Metzger violated the most basic standards of Aryan morality and behavior and have to be expelled from the folk and treated as the traitors and informers they have unquestionably become. On April 3rd, 1991, a judge ordered that all mail sent to Metzger's box be handed over by the post office to the then official receiver, Paul M. Weil, W-I-E-L, at P.O. Box 68, Carlsbad, California, 92008. Metzger was legally barred from changing post office boxes or doing business other than through Box 65. There were several changes of address and receiver until the final rejection of Metzger's appeal by the Supreme Court. In August 1994, the court order was made permanent with James McElroy designated as official receiver. So far as anyone knows, the seizure order was never lifted, and the seizure of Metzger's mail has been continuous for the past 16 years. The actual amount from this box is unknown, but in February of 1995, attorney James McElroy made a wide publicized trip to Ethiopia to hand over $100,000 of war money to the plaintiff in some godforsaken little mountain village. To be accurate, some of this money came from the seizure of Metzger's home and assets, but as was widely reported at the time, much of it also came from the post office box. The media found the idea of a dumb racist and skinheads sending money to help an African black to be hysterically funny and made quite a big deal over it. The amount of money which has been taken from Tom and John Metzger's mail by Morris Dees since 1991 by now must have reached a truly staggering sum. The interception of war mail is a matter of public record. Metzger himself admitted in 1991 that this was taking place, included a notice he issued through Fax News and other movement sources in which he stated his intention of allowing the box rent to expire and warned people to send no money to Box 65. In late 1992, all of a sudden, Box 65 was back in business. This was presumably when the deal was cut between Metzger and Dees to give Metzger his cut. Metzger kept on operating as war rather than have to go back to work for a living, and Dees acquired to most invaluable listening post ever achieved by the left into the white resistance movement in this country. In January of 1995, an extensive article in Metzger's hometown paper, the San Diego Union Tribune, was picked up by the wire services and published coast to coast. Morris Dees periodically gloats over his victory against hate in his assorted fundraising letters and publications. Stories appeared on tabloid TV shows, including Current Affairs and Hard Copy, and Arts and Entertainment Network special on hate groups, as well as regular news programs on CNN and the other major networks. The clincher came in a letter written to Harold Covington by Fallbrook Postmaster Robert J. Higgins, dated April 30, 1994. Higgins informed Covington that mail to P.O. Box 65, Fallbrook, is being handled in accordance with an agreement signed by both Tom and John Metzger. Over 2,000 copies of this letter have been circulated throughout the movement, for all the good it seems to have done. As with the Class and Myers buggery episode, and there is a section here about that, everybody knows there's some issues about Klassen as well. I don't support the creativity movement or the World Church of the Creator. Some of the work that Klassen wrote was good. Some of it was okay. Some of it was like over the top, like putting machine guns on the border. Sounds a little bit extreme when simply a wall can be built. But I wouldn't be against machine guns if it became necessary. But, you get my point here. But there were some questionable issues about Klassen. And I have used some of his work in some of my shows. And some of his work, again, is worth reading. However, they were promoting atheism. Now, at that time, there were very few people who were aware of spirituality in this movement. It wasn't until later, when more of the information about the Third Reich came to light. And again, I've said it once before, at least I've typed it out in messages to people. I don't know if I've said it on the air. The only people the Jews ever feared was the Third Reich, and all whose leaders at the top were spiritual Satanists. And again, spiritual Satanism is, or rather, let me rephrase that, National Socialism is political Satanism. Okay, if I have not said on one of my shows recently, then there you have it. I know I said it early on. If you go back and listen to my first show, I'm pretty sure I made that clear. Then I also made it clear on shows that were prior to that, on even another network that I was a guest on. Okay, back to the article. As with the Klassen Myers buggery episode, genuine documentary proof simply doesn't seem to have made any difference. People believe what they want to believe. At one stage, Metzger attempted to claim that John Metzger, at least, had bankrupted out of the civil judgment, but he never produced any documentary evidence or corroboration of this statement. This sounds plausible, but on examination by anyone even slightly familiar with pre-reform bankruptcy law, the claim doesn't stand up. Even before reform bankruptcy did not mean a judge simply saying, okay, off you go, you don't have to pay your debts. There were three basic types of bankruptcy. Chapter 13, which is a wage earner's plan, where you get your paycheck garnished for however long it takes to pay off a set amount to a receiver. Or Chapter 11 for businesses. And Chapter 7, the completely flat-busted, can't-pay-and-never-will-pay plan, which is presumably what John would have filed for. In each of these, after the petitioner's assets have been carefully examined and every cent paid out which can be managed, the judge then discharges or relieves the petitioner of his obligation to pay specific debts by named creditor and amount. In almost all cases, civil judgments and criminal fines are specifically excluded from bankruptcy relief. The law is written this way for the very purpose of ensuring that people who get fined or lose lawsuits don't wriggle out of it by declaring bankruptcy. It varies in individual cases, and it is not beyond the realm of possibility that John Metzger may have been able to obtain this rare type of civil relief. He must have had a hell of a lawyer if he managed it. But if that is the case, then it will be clearly stated in John's final bankruptcy decree that he is relieved and excused from paying the Portland judgment. Despite repeated challenges, neither Metzger has ever done so. checks made out to either Metzger come back endorsed with a rubber stamp, deposit to account number so-and-so. Since this anomaly was pointed out by Harold Covington and in the Cooper report, it is our understanding that the rubber stamp has been changed to read deposit to war account so-and-so, which is certainly the McElroy trust account for the Ethiopian. Neither Tom nor John Metzger actually endorses the checks. Let me take a drink of my drink here. Metzger reacted to the exposure of his obscene arrangement with Morris Dees with a series of violent, threatening, and abusive attacks against several people. One Harold Covington, a Dr. Edward R. Fields of the Truth at Last newspaper, and for some obscure reason, against Willis Cardo of Liberty Lobby. This included the shouting out of residential addresses of all three men on his telephone message, along with incitements to his skinhead children of the night or whatever to assault his critics and vandalize their property. To his undoubted disappointment, no one was stupid enough to take Metzger up on his incitements. Metzger's hysterical attacks on them were actually rather odd when one comes to think of it. They weren't the ones who were causing his problems. The combined readerships of all three of these men did not equal those of the Montgomery or San Diego papers, never mind the National Wire Services or CNN. Yet Metzger has launched a hateful campaign of threats and slander against these soft targets, only ignoring the main sources of the allegations against him, the mainstream media. Curiouser and curiouser, said Alice. And again, I can't guarantee that 100% of what I'm reading here is totally correct, okay? I didn't sit here and document all this stuff as time went on. You know, you hear this stuff going on, and it's like, okay, one more white leader down, not to be trusted anymore. You know, at the very least, it's questionable. You know, I mean, how can you at any point support anyone of these people after some of this seriousness of some of this? You know, something mild, you know, like I don't consider Cole to be an issue. You know, if he was or had a homosexual inclinations or was or is, whatever, you know, that would have nothing to do with anything else, in my opinion. I'm not going to get into the topic of homosexuality. However, I will say that there are homosexuals in the nationalist movement who are not flamers and well aware of the Jewish agenda. And that's all I can say of that. I don't know of them personally, other than just what I have been told, seen, and et cetera. So, anyway, that's not what my intention of this reading this information is about. Nor, by the way, is this intended in any way to promote Harold Covington, who has had allegations against him of working for the feds. So I don't trust anybody of any big name in this movement whatsoever. And anytime someone gets a big name, look out. Sooner or later, something's gonna pop up. It inevitably will. There's nobody here who's completely clean who's involved in this, I don't think, that will ever, at least on the top levels, you know, I'm never going to be. I guarantee you that. I don't want to be. I just want to be the sit here in the background and do my own thing. Let me clear my throat. Okay. Metzger has never in the past 16 years substantively addressed any of these allegations or provided any proof at all of the current status of the Portland civil judgment. In October 1994, a skinhead named Blaine Qualls was shot by Louisville, Kentucky police, prefiguring the later strange case of Bill White. A screaming and hysterical Metzger got on his recorded message and incited his followers to murder five Louisville cops by name, as well as threatening the Louisville district attorney and inciting people to make illegal, threatening, and harassing phone calls to the DA's office and to his home, which numbers Metzger gave out. Astoundingly, nothing at all was done about this. This is especially breathtaking in view of the fact that Metzger, having lost a civil case specifically for allegedly inciting others to homicide, was clearly in contempt of the judge's orders regarding the Portland verdict by doing so again in public. The Anti-Defamation League, the Center for Democratic Renewal, the Simon Wiesenthal Center, Morris Dees himself, and a number of law enforcement agencies surely monitored Metzger's message on a regular basis. The idea that they didn't hear that particular recording, which was on the air for a full week, is inadmissible. They heard Tom Metzger clearly committing a serious criminal offense, and they did nothing. Why? Metzger has also made a longtime practice of selling copyrighted material on video and audio tapes, including a police SWAT training film and tapes of illegal bare knuckles boxing bouts. Finally, in 1995, Metzger began blatantly taping and reselling for profit news segments off C-SPAN and CNN, especially the Waco and Ruby Ridge congressional hearings. He advertised these pirate copies on his phone message and in his literature. It is difficult to imagine super liberal media kingpin Ted Turner turning a blind eye to a supposed white supremacist pirating his copyrighted broadcast material unless Mr. Turner were presented with very persuasive reasons for doing so by someone mucho high up within the establishment. Significantly, the only time Metzger has ever been sued for copyright violation was by the makers of the Australian skinhead movie Romper Stomper, a foreign company outside Dee's circle of influence. From mid-1994 until early 1995, Metzger's recorded messages displayed clear signs either of substance abuse or else a decaying schizophrenic personality or both. In addition to serious lapses of judgment, such as the Louisville police incident already cited, Metzger's voice was slurred and at times incomprehensible. He would ramble on and on, his mind clearly wandering. In his pathetic July 4th message for 1994, Metzger admitted that he had previously consumed a 12-pack of beer. During this period, Metzger acquired from somewhere a toy laugh box where one pulls a string and raucous mechanical laughter comes out of the speaker. He kept pulling this sound effect on at inappropriate times during his monologues. On several occasions, he evidently began pulling the string convulsively, and either he could not stop himself or else he forgot he was doing it. The result was that long minutes of his presentation were accompanied in the background by idiotic crackling laughter. Listening to Metzger during this period was a pretty bizarre experience. From about March of 1995, Metzger managed to pull himself together somewhat. Publication of the war newspaper became more regular, and it eventually resumed a publication which was irregular but worked out to 5 or 6 issues per year. His recordings were eventually replaced by equally pointless rambling and apparently intoxicated internet screeds. A white nationalist visited Metzger over the Labor Day weekend of 1995 and reported that during his 4 or 5 hour stay, Metzger consumed almost an entire 750 milliliter bottle of vodka and several beers. The Observer reported an incident where John suggested Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Metzger jumped up, began flapping his arms, making clucking noises, and singing the commercial song, "I Feel Like Chicken Tonight, Like Chicken Tonight," for an extended period of time until his toupee slipped down on his head and he knocked over the vodka bottle. Now, of course, what I just read is obviously hearsay. Let me clear my throat. The Aryan racial resistance movement has a history of attracting a certain kind of people who have no business involved in our kind of politics or any kind. These people enter the movement for a variety of reasons, every one of them wrong. Lonely people in search of companionship, weak people in search of collective strength, mentally and emotionally disturbed people in search of therapy who end up inflicting terrible damage on a cause they genuinely wish to serve, etc. They are the winged monkeys of the bad craziness, and for a while, Tom Metzger was their wicked witch of the West. Let's be honest about things for once, okay? And I'm still reading this. Tom Metzger was never that good. Not really. Certainly not since about 1980 or whenever he started in on the Strasserite rubbish and the anti-Christian kick, the twin ideological kisses of death in the movement. Now, I just totally disagree with that. Obviously, this is written from a Christian perspective here. I don't know about the Strasserite rubbish. I don't recall offhand what that was. But the anti-Christian kick, you know me, right? But Tom did have one outstanding talent. More than any other movement snake oil salesman, he could get mileage out of people. It was all smoke and mirrors, but for a while there, he really had us all convinced he was going somewhere, when he was merely running laps. Metzger had just enough cunning, just enough plausibility, just enough media flair to get by for a while. Some people retain that cunning. David Duke, for instance, is still running laps and making a good living doing it. But Metzger didn't have the chops for the long haul. His mind went, he lost it, and he never recovered. Tom Metzger was the original. If you can't dazzle them with the brilliance, baffle them with bullshit, guy. Skinheads looking for a father figure were especially vulnerable. Metzger encouraged their destructive fantasies with specious claptrap about Aryan warriors and crude, violent cartoons. He demanded of them no organization, no self-discipline, no self-control, no mental or moral effort, no commitment, no hardship, no sacrifice, and above all, no work. All he demanded was their worship and every penny they could scrape up to buy his videos. He gave them in return a dangerous, deadly illusion. It is unknown how many skinheads and former skins are dead or are in prison today because they bought what Tom Metzger was selling. The number might well reach 100, nor can we accurately gauge how much mental and spiritual damage the man has done to hundreds of others, but it is tragic. Let me clear my throat. Okay. These kids came to him for hope, for guidance, for knowledge, and purpose in life. Metzger used them and threw them away like toilet paper. A classic example is his cowardly and despicable incitement on his telephone message, shrieking out the home addresses of his enemies and urging his brain-dead followers to commit criminal acts that he himself lacked the courage to carry out. He could not have cared less whether these kids who worshipped him got shot or sent to prison. But for a while, he looked good, and he fooled a lot of otherwise intelligent racialists, some of whom still defend Metzger rather than admit the unthinkable, that they made a mistake. Metzger himself carefully nurtured the idea that he was a great white leader. It was snake oil, of course, but no one likes to admit they have been conned by a snake oil salesman. Metzger understood one salient fact. Almost all racial nationalists, however hardened and skeptical they may think themselves, inwardly have a great longing to believe. Metzger capitalized on that and still does, as well as Duke and a few others who are still hanging on in the movement biz. It should be made crystal clear that the Portland lawsuit was totally pernicious, so tenuously based in law and so utterly antithetical to even the most basic concepts of freedom of speech and association that even orthodox civil liberties types have trouble swallowing it. Metzger got screwed big time. But he thought a good deal of the resultant disaster. He brought a good deal of the resultant disaster on himself. Tom's ego tripped him up. He was Tom Metzger, super racist, invincible, on TV every night. Suggestions that he and John might need some help were rebuffed. Who, him? Mighty Tom Metzger? Need the help of other racial nationalists outside his fan club who didn't bow down and aptly and apply the lips in the prescribed manner while singing Hosannas to Tom Metzger as the greatest thing since sliced bread? Ridiculous. So Tom went up alone against a sleazy but cunning legal reptile who knew the judicial system inside and out and who could play it like a violin. With, it has since been revealed, a $53 million cash reserve in his Southern Poverty Law Center, Tom faced a jury of liberals and moncoids in the most left-leaning city in the country. In court, he was arrogant, contemptuous, rude, boorish, constantly interrupting the judge and making wild and bizarre statements about how he would bring the whole temple down around them, if they didn't back off. Of course he lost. He was utterly stunned. The possibility that he could lose seems never to have occurred to him, and so needless to say, he had taken no steps of any kind to protect his assets. These flourish before him, a paper of the same kind the benighted and browbeaten Glenn Miller had signed a few years before, wherein Dees agreed to suspend collection efforts on the $12.5 million civil judgment until all appeals ran their course if Metzger would agree to disband war and surrender all his political rights under the First Amendment. Precisely how this offer to refrain from collecting any money served the interests of Dee's ostensible client, the semi-literate Ethiopian kefir whose name appeared on the lawsuit, is something the Oregon Bar Association's Legal Ethics Board has shown a remarkable disinterest in investigating. In one last defiant gesture, and let this be set down to his eternal credit, Metzger told Dee's to get stuffed. It is the last credit-worthy thing Tom Metzger ever did. So the torment began. Metzger's home and TV repair workshop were seized, all his tools confiscated, so he was unable to make a living, even had he been so inclined, and the Metzger family was forced onto welfare. All the War Office equipment and supplies, literature, T-shirt, and trinket inventory was seized and either sold or publicly burned by a triumphant Dees as the television cameras rolled. Kathy Metzger died in a hospital charity ward surrounded by blacks and third world garbage, something which makes Metzger's subsequent surrender to Dees even more contemptible. Despite Metzger's denials, the fact is that war operations virtually ceased. This couldn't be happening, not to Tom by God Metzger. Did they not realize he'd been on Oprah? Who do they think they were? Tom, by God, Metzger came down to earth with a mighty thump, and he didn't like it one little bit. Go back to fixing TVs, hearing that alarm going off every weekday morning at 6 a.m. for the rest of his life? His 15 minutes over? No. Tom Metzger's 15 minutes had to go on and on and on. And his appearance on Oprah, by the way, I was informed by people who have seen it, came off just like the Jews like for racialists to come off and give the racialists the negative image they have. Anyway, back to this article. But how? How could he get back on TV and sell his videotapes and trinkets and massage his ego and buy his plastic jugs of cheap vodka with Dees in 20 years of garnishee and court-ordered financial supervision on his back? I think that's garnishing. There is no telling which one made the first approach, Dees or Metzger. If it was Metzger, I'm sure Dees jumped at the chance. The hottest racist post office box in the country was an offer as a listening post, as well as a means of humiliating the hated white supremacists by making them fork over money unknowingly to a black man, which I'm sure made Morris titter. The amount of information which could be gathered in this manner was beyond anything Morris had ever had access to before. The gleanings from Box 65 were all been copied and cataloged. The identities of these people who wrote in good faith were duly passed along to Morris's buddies in the Justice Department, in the Simon Weiney Center, in the ADL, who in turn passed these records on to Israeli intelligence. It is virtually certain that at least a few people were probably murdered outright because of Metzger's treason, and others cast into the living hell of the prisons. Metzger finally threw in the towel in California, and several years ago moved into his retirement estate in Indiana, apparently left to him by a deceased great aunt or other aged female relative. He still has an internet site and keeps his hand in with occasional paper publications and toy sales, 50% of which still presumably go to Dees. We hear from him occasionally when one of his ravings pop up on the internet and the ghost of the dead and imprisoned skinheads moan and howl at his name. I didn't make that up. That's what it said. I agree. Moment of silence? Okay. All right. Well, there's still a little bit of time left in the two-hour part of the show here, if I'm looking at the clock correctly. And so let me tab on over here to my email, and hopefully I'll be able to get back over. I'll have to just modify the browser to do so. Let me clear my throat. Okay. I've got two things here. One is pretty short. This is an email exchange over at the Joy of Satan. And one person had requested, says, are there any National Socialist groups within the United States that aren't infested with the enemy or infiltrators? The first reply was this. Says, I doubt it. And I got to modify this a little bit here, just to make it, because it kind of doesn't make sense the way it was written. Something along the lines of wondering whether I should join or not, as because the stench of Christianity that was so bad, that was enough for them, okay? Besides Kikianity, Christianity in all forms exists, there will be Christian family values rather than satanic, truly pagan, and organic family and societal values. I need not go into detail about that, but those who know who I am will know exactly what I'm talking about. Love me, hate me, feel indifferent to me, but never put yourself on my bad side. Moving on. Then he says, Tom Metzger, who has a Kike surname, and by the way, it is also a Gentile name, and there used to be a baseball player on the Houston Astros in the 70s named Roger Metzger, and he is white, and he now lives in Brenham, Texas. So anyway, Tom Metzger, who has a Kike surname, has Christian pagan hybrid values Jewish plastered on his website. Basically, Jewish Christian pagan hybrid values on his website. He'll show pagan symbols and throw in some Lane and Klassen, but he has major issues. In addition, as High Priestess Maxine has said, he is an enemy agent on the Jewish payroll. Although what I said regarding Metzger is true, going the lone wolf route in the same vein as going the satanic route, where you leave flyers where they should go and educate those who may be worth your time and dispose of those who are not, which is what I am been what I have decided to do, and then encourage them to do the same thing, is the best way at the current time to create any change. They may sound like the pussy alternative, but those who go all out will lose their jobs, their homes, and all things that are necessary for life during this time, in the times in the future. What happened to Metzger? Okay, I just added that. Okay, do you really think that Kikes will allow open national socialists and or true Satanists to speak the truth out in the open without being assassinated? They already know who we are and where we live, meaning that we must watch our asses 24/7. As Satanists, we national socialists have lots of work to do before we can be put 6 feet under. Remember, true national socialism is Satanism. There is an esoteric occult side of Nazism and an exoteric or political compartment to it. National socialism is a way of life, and race is ultimately metaphysical, as our DNA is traced back to the Nordic gods. Malcolm X stated that we are of the devil. Ahriman means Aryan man. As satanic national socialists, we must realize that no healthy or permanent changes can be made without the satanic philosophy. We never separate the spiritual from the political, or vice versa. Now, let's see. There was one more reply in here. Kind of off topic a little bit. It goes off into some other areas, kind of not related to what I've been discussing here. But I do want to, again, remind everybody that Dr. Pierce did refer to Metzger as, quote, that Bolshevik, unquote. Okay, I'm going to end that one and go to the next one I've got here. And we've got about 5 minutes in the live 2 hour, but actually I'm doing this in a private show. No one even knows I'm doing this. But I'm watching the clock. So the last part of the show, and I'll try to get through this as quickly as I can because I have things to do here and I have to get ready for one more show. Actually, two or three. There will be a Texas show after my next show, and then I still want to get back to the issues that I was planning on getting to next on the list, and then also other issues that have been requested that I said I was going to try to do on the side to begin with, such as all the esoteric stuff. And by the way, someone had specifically requested that I do part of a show at least on the Baphomet. And it's kind of weird, but the past 3 weeks, one of the websites that I wanted to get information from has been down. It is now back up. I don't know what's going on with that, but it's up and running now. And also, too, ironically, the Black Sun website has been down for about that same length of time, and it is now back up. Finally. I don't know when it came up, but I wasn't going to it daily to find out. However, I did leave my browser open on the other one because I wanted to catch it as soon as it became available. And the first chance I get, I want to call the information from it. And like I said, call. I would never assemble an article that's called and put my name on it as if I wrote it. If I assemble it, I may say that it was called by me, unlike some people I have seen in this movement who will cull articles, put their name to it, may not say they wrote it, but by putting their name to it, it appears they wrote it. Okay, I'm going to move on. Okay. By the way, I was going to say what that the source of that other article was here. Let me get back over there real quickly and then come back to this, because I actually don't want to forget, and I figure that I might if I don't. It's called A Brief History of the White Nationalist Movement. Okay, let me get back now to where I was going. Okay, come on, scroll. Okay, here we go. Yeah, I get my browser back to full height on the screen. Okay, this is about the National Socialist Movement and an event that occurred on June 30th, 2006. Clifford Harrington has been the chairman of the National Socialist Movement, and I don't know for how long exactly. I don't keep up with all of this. Not to this level I probably should, simply because I just don't care. He is also a Vietnam War veteran. He is also married to the High Priestess Maxine Dietrich at Joy of Satan. And he has been definitely in the public as a National Socialist. Everybody who knows of him knows that he is a National Socialist. On the 30th of June 2006, in the city where they live, both of them came out of a grocery store after buying groceries and headed towards their vehicle. Well, Clifford, having been in the military, spotted something unusual about his vehicle, and they went back away from their vehicle, kept the distance, and notified the police. And apparently somebody tried to put a bomb on his car, and I believe the police were able to disarm the bomb. So I think that ought to tell you something about the importance of Satana Dharma, or Satanism, as being National Socialism, and the only thing the Jews have ever feared. Okay, this is from an email, and this is from an old email, so it's got all these greater than symbols on the left side as it's been forwarded a couple of times. So it's going to be choppy when I read it here. It's going to be a little hard to read as well. It's called The Source, The 30-Year War Against NSM. I am, as you know, the titular head of the NSM, chairman appointed by Robert F. Brannan in 1983 after serving as deputy chairman NSM due to his having sustained a major stroke and could not continue in that office. I have sustained the NSM through 1994 when I appointed Jeff Shope as Commander Uniform Divisions NSM and maintained my position as chairman. There was no break of command nor dispersion of same. I am still the chairman of the NSM, and this was written shortly after 2006. I don't know what the current situation actually is right at the moment. The NSM is divided into numerous uniformed divisions, sub-offices, and branches. The party main office is the NSM proper, intended as the umbrella group for which uniformed members are recruited. The PMO serves as the source of manpower, general support, and resources by which any organization has to operate. For without a large base of support, no organization of this nature can survive. There is an ad hoc deputy chairman of whom I will not refer or identify for various reasons. The NSM is designed per George Lincoln Rockwell's precepts and those based on experience of Adolf Hitler in any practical revolutionary organization. From 1974 at its founding, there has been an ongoing war against the NSM, facilitated by otherwise white nationalists who are the minions of the two-party Jewish diktat and knowingly have attempted to derail, sabotage, and otherwise destroy the NSM. The base for the creation of the NSM was in 1973 when, after stunning national successes by regional and local leaders, the previous organization, which had succeeded George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party, staged a tremendous successful blitzkrieg march. And it's a little hard to read here. Unannounced and unnoticed till it occurred in Cleveland, Ohio, formulated, planned, and guided by Casey Kalimba, a capable and active member in his own right. I think I pronounced that correctly. The march occurred during the 1973 Party Congress, at which all forms of security were in place to safeguard actual events. Dick Biederman was there, as well as numerous others I would become familiar with. The actual Congress occurred at Ukrainian Hall with well over 400 in attendance over 2 days. The march itself congregated in a local park at which uniformed and non-uniformed arrived with no inkling what was to take place. State Leader Kalimba, Biederman, and Matt Cole, erstwhile national commander of that organization, were there, as well as numerous national leaders from across the land. Okay, I just lost my spot while I was scrolling. There we go. Joseph Tomasi being prominent amongst them. In the park, the chief of police showed up, the mayor showed up, and various other Jews. Confronted by a fait accompli, the mayor grabbed the permit from Cole's hand, who stood stunned. Casey Kalimba grabbed it back and told the chief and mayor we were marching and there was nothing they could do about it, as it was in his name, and he could invite whomever he wished. It goes without saying that without his actions, the party would have faced a severe loss of face. At that point, Cole regained his head and told the chief if he arrested him, then all of us would go to jail, and they surely wouldn't want that to happen. As a result, we drove and convoyed in several trucks, flags flying, and 30-plus cars in tail with headlights on until we debussed downtown, formed up into columns of twos, and with banners flying, marched for 8 city blocks with no interference but a stunned citizenry to a park at which various leaders spoke for over 2 hours. No violence, no interference, no trouble. At the appointed time and place, all vehicles showed up, troopers and civilians boarded, and to the cheerful sounds of White Power, Sieg Heil, we convoyed out. That was the high point of the previous successor to George Lincoln Rockwell's American Nazi Party. 2 days of speeches, lunch, and events followed. During this triumphant event, it followed that Joseph Tomasi was sacked due to pressure from the establishment, who was bewildered by an upstart Nazi having taken money from the Republican Party in Los Angeles, California, to register Democrats for Governor George Wallace. When the Republicans reneged on the deal, Joe went to the press. It made headlines and was a major embarrassment to the establishment. On top of the ongoing tete-a-tete with LA officials, pressured by the feds, Cole caved in and demanded that the LA property be turned over to the party and sacked comrade Tomasi. Joe was stunned, as he believed and sincerely that his show of loyalty would be proof positive that he stood with the commander. Side note information has recently arisen that individuals including Metzger and none other than David the Duke. Duke incidentally began as an ersatz Nazi at the University of Louisiana, and I have a picture of him in uniform. Old news, I know, but he created the White Youth Alliance promoted by NSWPP/NAP, of which I have a picture of him promoting and speaking in Free Speech Alley and wearing the red armband with Sunwheel, and several others were intimately involved in this conspiracy against the NSWPP, or the old ANP, and contributed significantly to its demise. For years subsequent to that, many others followed in this wake. Alan Vincent in San Francisco, Casey Kalimba in Cleveland, offices in Philadelphia, St. Louis, Spokane, Florida, Kentucky, everywhere the ANP successor garnered success, the rug was pulled out, pulled from under the local success of the activist leader and others to the dismay, disillusionment, and astonishment of the rank and file. The successful march of 300 uniformed Nazis being the straw that broke the camel's back. The establishment couldn't believe it, and the Jews put out the word it had to stop. The various pressures and intimidation of the weak Matt Cole now serve their purposes and subsequently is what emboldened Comrade Robert F. Brannan, Steve Love, James Mason, myself, Clarence A. Brandenburg, one of the Ohio National Knights, Captain Joe Tomasi, George Zapparelli, heir apparent Prince of the House of Lombardy, to establish the NSM as an alternative. I am charter member number 7, Chairman Brannan, known as the cigar-smoking Nazi locomotive of Cincinnati, was unanimously designated the chairman. That's what it says. I held out for a while as I subsequently moved while in the U.S. Army to Arlington and became the local group leader and part of security for the headquarters, leading numerous forays into all-black Washington, D.C., and demonstrations as well as the Blitz propaganda commandos picketing, selling the then white power newspaper of the old NSWPP, which was heir of the ANP, and I saw what was happening in Arlington, held my tongue, and remained erstwhile loyal to the straw that broke the camel's back. My wife was at that time working in the headquarters to help out with paperwork. I appreciate the sense of gratitude and indemnification by Mr. Cole, but otherwise leadership of a substantial nature and quality was noticeably lacking. Military experience is all important, unless you have a mentor or a good military-trained lieutenant. I resigned from the party and at that time became a full-fledged NSM member and supported Captain Tomasi with advice and assistance in organizing the National Socialist Liberation Front. Based on experience from history and advised that this was premature, as I advised Captain Tomasi. Shortly thereafter, the NSM took off as many experienced and disheartened individuals were leaving the previous ANP group. Okay, hopefully that made sense. There was a footnote. Mr. Brandenburg actually fought and won a landmark Supreme Court case involving the restrictions of distribution of political literature in and on the grounds of shopping malls, a real hard fighter. Let me clear my throat. Subsequently to this white confederacy, a white nationalist organization eventually composed of over 20 different organizations was formed, providing an umbrella group contemplating this was the National Socialist Congress, a group of national socialists throughout the composed of independent national socialist organized groups and associated affiliates around the world. Amongst these were NSDAPAO, Gerhard Lauck, L-A-U-C-K, Frank Collins, NSPA, Chicago NSM, of course, with its numerous local adherents, White Power Publications of George P. Dietz out of West Virginia, Alan Vincent of the National Socialist American Workers Party, local group Rockwell, NSM, yours truly, Clifford Harrington. The overwhelming responses across the country was tremendous. Now, there's been allegations about Frank Collins. I don't remember what those were offhand. If you watch any documentary on like the History Channel or whatever about the American Nazis, it will come up. So I don't remember offhand what it was. But his name has been, what's the word I'm looking for? Destroyed or whatever. At least on the public image it has. I don't know about the movement itself. I don't get involved in all this stuff. I just think this is important and interesting. At least it has been to this point. Where was I at? Okay, there we go. The overwhelming response across the country was tremendous. At one point, the NSM was sending out 1,000 copies of the National Socialist magazine, besides the NSM bulletin, and had affiliates in 20 foreign countries and over 35 states. Unbeknownst to the general NSM charter members, the coalition was forming at the instigation of individuals whose main driving forces were still tied to those which caused the diffusion of the successor to the GLRANP, offering to publish the magazine at cost. The then WP Pubs then demanded the NSM hand over its mailing list as payment for the at-cost charges. Besides this, they had been publishing the previous predecessor's publications and still had extensive ties to it. Matt Cole had by then folded up, having sold all the properties he could lay his hands on, dismissing or discharging the vast majority of dedicated and loyal National Socialist personnel and relocated to the woods of Wisconsin, better to propagandize and educate the American people from hiding. The NS Congress met in Chicago in 1976, and there was an attempted Democratic voting bloc to try to seize the NSM lock, stock, and barrel. NSDAP-AO Gerhard Lauck was part and parcel of this, with the incredulous attempted Democratic standard that all organizations would hand over their membership list to the then titular head of the NS Congress. Comrade Brannon and others saw through this and flat refused to do so, immediately after which the overbloated charges for at-cost charges for publishing the NS magazine. Subsequent to this was the famous Fountain Square Rally in 1978, in which the NSM and various allies, not to exclude SS Security Services, a most vibrant and revolutionary street activist affiliate of the NSM and NS Congress, 30 of us, stood toe-to-toe with 2,000 screaming, fuming, spitting, Yiddish-smelling apes of the worst kind. International news was overwhelming, and we continued to grow. Let me clear my throat. And light a cigarette. Previous to this was a huge anti-PR campaign by the establishment against the NS Congress, its growth, and the NSM in particular. The NSM was fingered at the French newspaper Le Monde, 1978, as the most dangerous NS organization since Adolf Hitler. The growth and support was overwhelming. Activism from all over the world, marches, meetings, propaganda, campaigns, National Socialists were everywhere. Almost not a day went by then the NSM in particular received press attention, which only served to spread our name further. I was appointed Deputy Chairman NSM in 1983, referring to Clifford Harrington. Okay. Let's see here. NSM Interregnum, 1984, NSM founding and subsequent events. After being designated chairman of the NSM, which I never imagined in my life, I had to set about my modus operandi and look towards establishing it as an institution. At this time, I was working in a medium-sized Oklahoma city, which afforded me normative quiet and semblance of security, although this was farthest from my mind, but which the vicissitudes of life allotted me. I began by continuing the publications which I had inherited, namely the NSM magazine, and establishing several others, namely the NS Nationaler, designed to further the international worldwide NS movement and publicize events and activities of all our brother National Socialist organizations. Insofar as the erstwhile World Union of National Socialists was for all practical purposes dead. Further, I added another modest contribution named Social Justice. Yes, drawing on the famous Peter Coughlin of American Social Justice. F-T-T-H-R, that's got to be a misspelling. American Social Justice Movement, and also continuing the NS Bulletin and adding a refinement for internal usage only and instructions only, the NS Brief. All these kept me going 24/7. In addition, I added a white power message line, which was an essential verbal adjunct to the propaganda tools that a movement or organization has to have. One cannot rely on one means only, but all aspects of the total propaganda arsenal, spoken, written, literature, commandos, graffiti, and inaction. These are all essential elements necessary for the propagation of an idea. Let me clear my throat. The events of the next 6 years proved me right. And although I was hobbled by lack of finances, I was not hobbled by a lack of enemies who in the right wing kept on the paces to do damage to the only organization that was not controlled by establishment sellouts. Attacks were directed at the old ANP and NSWPP, were then guided towards us and the NSM, the typical panoply of personal, economic, psychological, and physical attacks were commonly up and down. On the main events that occurred this period of time were the virtual closing down of the telecommunication systems in my part of the state and subsequent newspaper coverage of that, of the fact that a lone WP message unit could cause so much havoc. I did not publish or promote the WPM publicity, but only in our erstwhile internal publications. I met the guidelines and was circumspect in my wordage and news. I had by this time volunteers on a local basis who came to me through third parties, and I utilized their voices for these messages in addition to my own. The effect, obviously, was impact, showing that it was not just a lone individual, but one who could draw on others to forward the idea. The skinhead movement took shape in north central and northeastern Oklahoma, and I had occasion to meet with several of these leaders locally, and of course, one name started to pop up, Tommy Metzger and Dennis the Menace Mahan, whom I was later to meet, but I warned the local skin leaders, good young men and with inborn leadership, to be wary of these personalities. Lo and behold, another story, it came to pass on the heels of the Metzger's Portland, Oregon affair. A Fed task force was sent off to Tulsa to deal with these white nationalists on the heels of the Oklahoma City Alfred P. Murrah building bombing. Subsequent events saw many of these growing resistant leaders, let alone their followers, use, I might add, would wound up in federal prison. And of course, Metzger and Mahan were never to be seen at this time. Remember Johnny Lee Clary, the vaunted worldwide evangelist and purveyor of wine, women, and interracial miscegenation, was active with the vaunted White Knights of Oklahoma. And again, never touched for all their vaunted guidance and maturity. But the skinheads were having an effect, and to the detriment of the local establishment, desire to break the local homogeneity and cohesiveness of the white community. Crime rampant, rapes on the upsurge, and this also correlative to the press campaign to make Whitey feel guilty over the world-renowned riots of 28. The skins were resisting and it was spreading. The feds couldn't tolerate it and their string pullers insisted the skins be shut down. At the same time, NSM, now headquartered in Oklahoma, was making headway via media and individual members to maintain and grow with the intent of spiting the enemies of NSM. Several major radio stations interviewed Chairman Harrington, communications from all parts of the world expanding and local harassment increasing. I knew, however, that I needed to take the battle to a major metropolitan area based upon my experience in other areas namely the national rallies that had been held with the NS Congress, the ANP, (NSWPP) in Cleveland and elsewhere, those close parentheses after the WPP, and elsewhere, the Fountain Square rally in 78, and the many, many personal examples of Casey Columba of Cleveland, Joe Tomasi of Louisiana, and hundreds of unnamed others, I determined on relocating to Minneapolis. It just seemed destiny was drawing me there for a multiple of reasons. Now, I'm going to stop and play a little bit of music and then come back. I'm not sure how much longer this is here as far as time goes. Hopefully I can get it in and I won't be cut off. So let me go to the other computer here, find a song that I want to play, and take a brief break here. Let me see. I have a whole bunch of stuff in here now because I've done some music shows, and I haven't deleted all of them because I know I'm going to use some of them as well. So anyway, this looks good for right now. All right, play. Come on. This is the other computer that I always have a problem with the browser on, trying to get a button to play on, and it's just being par for the course. Here we go. back to this long article here. Hopefully I can get this finished in the next half hour, and hopefully BTR does not cut me off. If it does, I will continue this as a perhaps just a small show just to wrap up the article. It'll wind up delaying my other scheduled show further. However, it's important that I finish this. And back to the article. An incidental aside to this is how the U.S. of Jews actually operates, with significant positions either held by or directed by Jews. When I departed my Oklahoma residence, I checked the mails, and an individual there who I knew and had recently been hired by the post office told me on the side, "You know, Mr. Harrington, I like you, and I have only been working here a short time, but I have to tell you, the local post office master ordered literally sacks and sacks of mail sent to your P.O. box destroyed. They filled a small room." Actually, the answer I was expecting, as we had numerous ongoing issues with non-delivered mail for the past 6 years there. You can't trust a Jew on his word nor a fox on the heath. So much for pre-democratic, liberty-loving Jews. But that as it may, in 1988, I relocated to Minneapolis and began with the help of Mrs. Harrington, a hardcore dyed-in-the-wool National Socialist, to get my footing. This is H.P. Maxine Dietrich, who is, I believe, from Minneapolis. We held several dinners to which all national patriots were welcomed with open arms. $5 donation and all you can eat. Christian identists, Minutemen, Klansmen, skinheads by the score, Nazis, and of course, your kosher provocateurs. Films, speeches, and social intercourse, of course, with good meals, laced with pork and everything, when announced for a specific purpose, which had the effect on several of the non-sincere types of making them run or puke, as the case may be. East St. Paul was a favorite venue, as this area was becoming infested with illegal Mexican nationals and the ensuing turmoil, which always accompanies ethnic, racial, read, multicultural, integrationist change. I gathered several volunteer recruits around me. We started with stickers of the NSM variety and plastering leaflets in Metal Town. This had the effect of spreading the word we were there and also a warning. One individual who came to me, a long-haired, aspiring would-be musician, that's what it says, probably meant would-be musician, who was extremely troubled by his lifestyle in the Little Apple, would never have known, but at once of our dinners, he approached me and wanted to talk. Let me relight this cigarette. It keeps going out because I got a fan going here. I let him talk. He told me about the opportunities he had with his band, a neophyte rock and roller of the heavy type, about the women being thrown at him, the booze, the drugs, and the money. He was on the verge of a break. I let him talk to unburden himself as he felt troubled by all this. And deep down in his heart, he relieved himself. I asked about his family, about his ancestors, about it, what he really wanted in life. I showed him we were sincere, truthful, idealistic, and only wanted the best for our people. That we recognized the right of all peoples to exist without interference from artificial experiments. He told me all the anti-arguments about us, but the question still nagged at him. As his grandfather had been a general of the German army, although he had been born in Holland. Probably the Netherlands. Holland is just a small part of the Netherlands. Basing much of my argument on a CI initiation I saw in the background. I told him to call me anytime he wanted to or just come and visit. Now, keep in mind, Clifford Harrington is not Christian identity, okay? There's no way, not if his wife is the high priestess of the joy of Satan, okay? Lo and behold, I was in a state of shock when several weeks passed and he showed up at my door and I couldn't believe my eyes. It was him, this young man who had almost passed into the material unknown and would have had money, fame, and good God knows what else. skinhead, black BDUs and and shirt and boots. BDUs are battle dress uniforms. Military terminology. I enrolled him, swore him in, and we celebrated with a bratwurst and beer, and then went on a propaganda run on a budget of all of $5. His name was and is Jeff Shope. One of the first things I did was to show my growing adherence that demonstrating in brown shirt and swastika armband could be done without fear of anything. With video camera, still camera, and picket sign, support the PLO, stop Jewish terrorism in our post office box so it could be read from across the street. I alone picketed in front of the federal building for over an hour and a half with no interference, with cars driving by and tooting their horns in support, with individuals waving and Sieg Heiling. This had not been done in Minneapolis since the late 70s. Security is paramount regardless of numbers. The blitzkrieg tactic is most important. Plan, organize, assign squads, specific areas, or point of rendezvous. Only squad leaders need to know the preliminary assembly point. Pickets, signs, always in Hakenkreuz party banner. That's the swastika, in case you don't know what the Hakenkreuz is. Have purportedly passerby, okay, let me start somewhere where that makes sense. Picket signs always, Hakenkreuz party banner. Have a purported passerby notify the media. Have them listed about 20 minutes into the demo security. Only the leader and second in command needs to know the final destination. Assign cameras and an innocent bystander with still camera. Perhaps even have a reaction squad on standby headed by a hardcore determined and trusted individual in case of trouble. Strike. Designate a specific pickup time and with trusted drivers on a march to secured area. An hour and a half is generally considered good in a way. Always but always have some form of celebratory post-action function. In Cincinnati, we frequently went to a couple of favorite restaurants in full uniform, and the reception was never ugly. Clear my throat. I showed my ID to the Fed security and stayed on the sidewalk and marched back and forth, back and forth. Additional recruits were won. This is why I was moved to go to Minneapolis, this young man. I eventually appointed him head of the NSM Skinhead Division, and he did not disappoint me. He had the youth, the knack, and savvy to draw non-uniform white youth to our events and political demonstrations, many of them, organized as youth would be, friends, associates, and phones. It wasn't unusual to put out a call, just like Joe did in L.A. or Kalimba in Cleveland or Vincent in San Francisco, and have dozens show up to join the action. One even in particular occurred at the Star Tribune. White youths were being accosted and beaten and girls molested in the schools. We, Shope and I, and one student rep went to the said school to hand a letter to the principal. We entered, they shuttered, and the students walked out in protest of the school and their multicultural hypocrisy, and the principal hid. Ongoing with this, we decided to picket the Star and Sickle Tribune. At every event, I had a still camera and a video for evidence. The call went out, and with Viking youth banners and party banner flying, we picketed the said establishment for over an hour. Non-uniformed white youths and uniformed party members showing the integrationists that there was and is white resistance. We carried out regular weekend propaganda walks through East St. Paul with banner flying and a picket sign, always in camera stationed strategically. Never a bit of trouble except one time a van load of sodden World War II vets thought they would try us on, and as we marched through the park, pulled abreast but a ways from us, I told my compatriots to stay to the side. If anything happened, take them out. I approached the van and had a few words with the vet in an amicable way, but he wouldn't get out. Why are you here? He said. In retort, I said, what did you fight World War II for? To have blacks and Mexicans pillage your neighborhoods? He replied, well, not to have Nazis in the world. And I replied, you won't have anything if those alien races have their way. At which time, about the same as the passenger in the back started to get out with his shotgun, police arrived, queried us all, and arrested the vets with their sodden palers and shotgun. I'm sure they won't forget that. to which we responded by marching off, swastika flag flying. Jeff Shope did not disappoint me, but he was harassed, intimidated, and worse. I myself went to his aid on a couple of occasions when called upon. He lost his apartment for showing a swastika flag in his window. He lost his girlfriend to unofficial harassment law authorities put up to it by the kosher string pullers. He lost his car and his family threatened him. I myself, during my sojourn in the Little Apple, had to move several times. I lost several jobs. All this due to living in the land of the free kosher diktat of the American democracy. But he didn't give up. I didn't and wouldn't give up and won't. One incident worth noting, the Jewish penchant for illegal activities, is when I decided to go to the post office to complain to Postmaster Frank and inspectors about mail which never arrived. This was in 1991. As I approached my mailbox, I noticed a typically seedy-looking, short, nefarious character seemingly hanging around, about 40 to 50 years of age, an obviously rotund little sawed-off Jew. I made sure he didn't see me, but I saw him check several boxes, and then he walked straight up to the NSM box and proceeded to open it. He had a key in our mailbox. I complained verbally to and in written form to the above-mentioned individuals to no avail. They sneered. Well, I had already had them change the lock and got two new keys. Shortly after that, the mail resumed. But to this day, Postmaster Frank and his Noir dwellers are still up to their questionable habits. As recently as October 2007, an uninsured parcel was shipped to NSM Minneapolis, Minnesota, and lo and behold, the wrapping came back, found on bulk shipping floor. Please complete enclosed materials for search and claim. Hell will freeze over before anything turns up, I'll wager. This song went on for several years, including the addition of a WP message unit, which was going steady as if they didn't know you exist. How can they find you or help you in the cause? However, my health had deteriorated, and I had subsequently appointed Jeff the commander of Uniform Division NSM. And after this, my supposed resignation, see events of June 30th, blah, 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 blah. Okay, that was a reference there. So anyway, he says here, I needed a break. Let me light a cigarette. Looks like we got a little under 20 minutes left here, or approximately 20 minutes, and I'm still going. Okay, it says, I moved from Minneapolis back to Oklahoma for a breather and established adjunct offices and needed support units for our continued activities. This is where Mr. Billy Willie White, ersatz, Jewish Nazi, gets his tale, as told to him by Dennis the Schemer Mahon, that I fled Minnesota due to involvement with a young woman, but as was addressed, involved none other than two young kids who had been both thrown out of their homes by real understanding hypocrites, as it were. I have more Christian charity in me than most of these gaudy Chosnick believers do of what was going on in their schools who had sought refuge with me and my family. So much for believing a Jew on his word or a drunk on his memory. Hey, Willie Mahon. As it were, Commander Shub did wonders and sought out with an open hand support of others like minded. After 20 years of toil, it had taken its toll on myself. The NSM is where it is at today and continuing to march in line with the historical clock, an institution due to his efforts and mine in maintaining the idealism and fervency of our beliefs. It was a threat, and will remain a threat to the Jewish multicultural two-party diktat as long as I exist and the commander does not compromise with Noir dwellers and sanctimonious hypocrites. Prior to departing Minnesota, I had appointed Jeff Shope commander of the Uniform Division NSM. Jeff has put all his effort into the NSM. He succeeded in establishing a website for same, and believe me, it was difficult, with all the wheeling and dealing having to do. I appointed Commander Shope for a very singular reason, his youth and ability to interface and form a transition line to keep a link with our history and establish the NSM as an institution and keep the fight alive, as my health has not been the best and looking towards the future. Commander Cho has tried with many formulations, constantly changing horizons and the liquidity and uncertainty and untrustworthiness of the many so-called right-wing groups and individuals to bring us all together in the spirit of racial camaraderie and brotherhood for the benefit of our peoples. We continue to have literature runs, sticker placements, attend meetings of other groups, including meeting Richard Butler in Hayden Lake, Idaho, where he was attacked by a couple of anti-racist skinheads pretending to be Nazis, adherents of Butler. Refer the vaunted White Knights, part 6, page, last paragraph. And that went back to the, like, what I had already read. It was first and foremost of his own actions to serve as a leading light and figure to admire for others to follow. Just FYI, this is page 14. He has been beset by the same vicissitudes and tribulations any human would be exposed to. As Adolf Hitler said, if I am not vilified in the Jewish press on a regular basis, I am not doing my job. And the very fact that his has maintained his psychological balance is a credit. He has been physically attacked with a tire iron, shot at, and his vehicle destroyed. Besides the stress of operating a patriotic organization constantly under attack, Jeff and I kept in contact, and I tried to reestablish an economic basis on which to further my goals of setting up the support offices for the uniformed divisions. Jeff attended numerous other right-wing meetings and continued his zealous activities. I began to republish the NSM magazine again in 1998 when resources finally became available, and then flew to attend the famous 1998 news conference brawl in East St. Paul, which was attended by Comrade Alan Vincent of the erstwhile National Socialist White Workers' Party. This was what pushed the NSM into the limelight. As we assembled in convoy to the government building in East St. Paul, a certain individual from Texas, whom I warned the commander was a Jew, was put in charge of notifying the media and additional supporters who arrived late. When we arrived at the location, a underfed Jew miscreant druggie was waiting on us. The news media was already there, and this miscreant stole something from their van. Lo and behold, the media was interviewing me, and this miscreant Jew attempted to approach and stab me with a hidden knife. The media reacted swiftly when I told them he had just stolen something from their van and held the little kike bastard back. The remainder of the convoy showed up, and with flags flying, we marched a few hundred yards to the government center. While in column, the little miscreant druggie Jew sucker punched me from the side by leaping a short wall as we turned into our positions. He did dislocate my jaw, and luckily, as he was aiming for my temple, would have killed me, which I am sure was his intention. But recovering, as he made his getaway, I continued in the column and positioned myself on the south end of the picket line. Forming a literal picket line, the Reds came swarming from all directions. They were organized and had been notified by the miscreant Jew from Texas where we were. Flagpoles swinging, fists flying, punches thrown. The media had a heyday. For all of 15 minutes, Comrade Vincent tried to get subsequent word bites that the media would record pertinent to the ongoing fight and why we were there. Police, although with earshot around the corner, did not respond. Wonder why? Under orders. Didn't we hear that at Nuremberg? Which is true, particularly for Americans, as they don't want to lose their cushy little jobs. But aren't we taught no to question orders? Don't the Jews do this to our military to this day? Doesn't it involve a courts-martial, if you do? More Reds were coming, using all weapons they had, illegal and otherwise. The comrade unit leader from Ohio had to grab me from behind, as I did not hear the word to disengage and move out. He literally dragged me along as we caught up to the departing fighting column. However, he and I and company rear guard fighting, he collapsed under my feet, and I stood over him screaming at the top of my lungs, "Cease fire, man down." A little spick Jewish responded by, it's our neighborhood. We don't want you here. All the while, I was encouraging Ohio unit leader to get up, observing the other vehicles were preparing under attack to leave. He finally responded, and away we went. This was a question of literally fight and die or retreat to fight another day. We fight our way back two blocks to the cars and had to fight off attacks which smashed several windshields. The gangs attacked our vehicles and several standing fights ensued outside the vehicles. But finally we made our way while several other independent comrades had approached from across the pedestrian bridge and were attacked. Although heavily engaged, no serious inquiries occurred. And we made our way to a favorite restaurant in full uniform to relive the minutes of this event. Suffice to say, even though I objected to the miscreant Christian identity Jew from Texas handling communications, and I know he fed them the information where we were to be for the news conference, it was a necessary event as it put the NSM on the map again. The coverage was a heavy local, state, and national, international. We were on the move again. The subsequent years have seen Commander Shope enlarge the NSM uniform divisions in many ways. NSM radio and TV, several e-groups, and NSM merchandise outlet, numerous rallies and sallies, pickets by the score, leading up to Lansing, Michigan, 2006, where after numerous open-handed symbols of friendship extended to all groups and organizations, and seeing a couple here and there, and everybody wanting to be their own great leader, with always one or two showing up in alliance, excepting a few, namely New Jersey Skins, the Connecticut Skins, the Liberty Skins, and a couple of others, no one surpasses the NSM, and of late reestablished the World Union of National Socialists, which went defunct under the old successor of Rockwell's and ANP, establishing and will continue to innovate and establish secondary support officers, all for the succor, benefit, and preservation of our vote. Fighting for family, race, and nation. Okay, I'm getting close to the 3-hour point. Still a little bit of time left, though. I just want to mention something here. You know, this goes back, you know, like 5 years ago. I don't know what the circumstance is now of this group, and I think I mentioned that earlier, but I just want to reiterate that. And I don't know what the story is with Shope. Hopefully he has not been had some sort of downfall like many of these others in the groups have. However, Clifford Harrington is still Clifford Harrington. And I don't know, again, what the status of any of this is anymore. I do not keep up with it. However, there's a point to what I'm saying here, and I'm hoping that everybody is getting that without me having to explain it. So. I just want to make sure I got that in before the show comes to an end. The closer it gets to 3 hours, the more apt Blog Talk Radio is to just stop. So, anyway, and again, if it does stop, I will maybe do a little short show or something. So anyway, we'll see. It appears there's still a little ways to go. So. And it really appears like it's looking that way. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to find a stopping point somewhere in the next 5 minutes, okay? And then we'll pick it up at a later point. And we extend the hand of friendship to all sincere national patriots. But when the NSM on its own started showing up 50, 80, 100, 135, 200 uniformed and non-uniformed members on our own, the establishment got worried, just like in 1973, when the old ANP marched in Cleveland, Ohio. It had to be stopped. As Adolf Hitler stated, action, action, action. If I am not vilified in the Jew press daily, I'm not doing my job. Okay, I guess I read that. Okay, anyway. Further, that the alliances with the Black Front, namely pseudo-nationalist groups in the end, do not pan out, as they put too many demands on a strong, vibrant, and honest organization. We have to go it alone and by our own sincerity and devotion and willingness to sacrifice to save our nation and people. Okay. Come on, computer, cooperate. It's not scrolling. Okay, I have held my tongue, not for want of anything to say, for practically a year. However, this was not done because of any guilt, which I will never accept, but to let chips to fall where they may and the smoke to settle and the dust to clear. I have always maintained as a National Socialist moral integrity, model behavior, and honorable character. I have been loyal to and never a member of any other group except as a National Socialist of the ANP of Rockwell and the NSM. I am not an egotist, but I do recognize abilities not only in others but in myself, and also recognize the lack or want of same in others. Admittedly, one individual is not the whole story, as I have always told everyone whom I came into contact with, but I have maintained as a historian that individuals of certain gifts and powers and abilities must be cared for, nourished, and encouraged. I, for one, have never compromised my character, honor, integrity, and have never, as opposed to others, sold mailing lists, compromised with the Jews or legal authorities, but with my steadfast integrity stood my ground. Okay, bug, get off my screen. And I have never profited from my political activism in any form. Let me clear my throat. That being said, let the chips fall where they may. Okay. Let's see here. This is I'm looking for a spot. Okay. I'm going to read two more items here, and then I'm going to call it quits. The NSM has been on a roll. Presumably it still is, but in a lower profile but significant manner for now. This always poses a threat to the establishment, and is always the Jewish two-party diktat on the lookout for these renegades. History shows it. The events of April 2006 and June 30, 2006 were preceded by an unheard attack on NSM members who openly challenged all in attendance at Nordic Fest to activism. Their answer was an unprovoked attack on Comrade Boswell of Missouri, who shall be remembered by me forever as a loyal Aryan, tremendous courage by erstwhile white patriots, social Vinlanders who claimed they were insulted by these remarks, a smack to them of indicting them for non-activity on the streets, which, in fact, they, the social clubs, were and are not guilty of. Okay, I'm going to call it quits. And I'm going to bring up my notes again to read my usual endings. So, again, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? Some final thoughts. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's... I was going too fast, and I lost... Okay, it's been a while since I have read this, okay? Okay, if you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Religion leads to racial death. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hail Satan, and I will do the show in response to Renegade next. This is a prerequisite for that show, the first part at least, and part of what I just got through reading, and we'll continue to read. So, we will be talking to you again soon.